Okay, and an official welcome to everyone to our Strong Gravity seminar this week. It's a pleasure to have Alvin Chua with us today from JPL. Alvin got his bachelor's from the Australian National University and then moved on as a PhD student to the University of Cambridge. He's at JPL now, but as I just learned, only for a little while, he's moving on to Caltech for another postdoc. And so, yeah, we're glad to have you with us today, Alvin, and we're excited to hear about the extreme mass ratio in spirals. So please take it from here.
Right. Thank you, Daniel. First of all, I'd like to say thank you as well to all the organizers at Parameter Institute for inviting me to give this virtual seminar. So, okay, I'll start my talk off with several broad introductory topics, such as the inverse problem in gravitational wave astronomy, and then a broad overview of the LISA mission, and then an overview of the particular class of LISA source that I'll be focusing on today, which are extreme mass ratio in spirals, or EMRIs for short. So in the second half of the talk, I'll then provide some updates on recent developments in the EMRI inverse problem, specifically a framework for the next generation of EMRI waveform models, as well as a new picture of the space of EMRI signals that is defined by a given waveform model and a given data analysis setting. So, okay, this is just a bit of a preamble slide to set things up for the rest of the talk. So, okay, an inverse problem in science is to deduce the causal factors that underlie a set of observed data. So this typically makes use of parameterized forward models for the observables in the physical problem. So in gravitational wave astronomy, the basic example is of course that of a waveform model, which describes the response of the detector to a gravitational wave signal from an astrophysical source. So there are other important forward models too, including those for detector noise or for source populations. So all of these forward models are then used together in statistical analysis to find inverse solutions for the parameters of the source, given the data. Now, because gravitational wave data is dominated by noise, the inverse solution also needs to address whether a signal is even present in the first place. So the traditional name for this procedure is called detection. So that's separate from inference, or what we know as parameter estimation, in the ground-based context. But for LISA, the distinction between detection and inference is actually less clear-cut. So since both parts of the inverse problem in gravitational wave astronomy are quite non-trivial, they are usually solved in very different ways and often by separate communities. But I think it's useful to keep in mind always that they are ultimately flip sides of the same problem. Okay, so the laser interferometer space antenna, LISA, is a space-based gravitational wave detector. So its design uses 6 inertial masses housed in 3 spacecraft that are separated by 2.5 million kilometers. So the spacecraft are drag-free in the sense that they don't apply forces to the masses along the interferometry axes. And they also communicate with one another through laser transponders. So LISA, this triangle here, would place in orbit around the sun, trailing 20 degrees behind the Earth. So the animation shows the cartwheeling motion of the LISA constellation on its orbit. And LISA will be operational for 4 years with the possibility of extension up to 10. Okay, so LISA is in space because we want to observe the millihertz band of the gravitational wave sky. So that ranges from 0.1 millihertz to 1 hertz. And putting a detector in space removes noise from large scale changes in Earth's gravitational field. And also it allows us to have longer arms, which give greater sensitivity at low frequencies. So the lengths of LISA's arms are not really constant, of course, but the data can be processed to give 3 standard interferometric combinations that are linearly independent to each other. So 2 of these are essentially the familiar Michelson type interferometers, but with 60 instead of 90 degree arms, shown here. These will measure the 2 gravitational wave polarizations. And the 3rd is a Sagnac interferometer, which is a common path configuration that is largely insensitive to gravitational waves. So it can be used to measure noise in the data instead. So funding has already been approved for LISA, which was selected as the 3rd large class mission in ESA's Cosmic Vision program. The scheduled launch date is 2034. However, work has already formally begun and a prototype design for the instrument and the data processing framework is required within the next 5 years, I think, yeah. So this is when the mission will be adopted for the implementation phase. Okay, so here I'll also briefly mention the proof of technology mission, LISA Pathfinder, which concluded in 2017. It was a resounding success. So Pathfinder had two inertial masses placed in the same spacecraft, just 40 centimeters apart. And the spacecraft was put in orbit around the Earth-Sun L1 Lagrange point. And because of this much shorter separation between the test masses, Pathfinder was not sensitive to gravitational waves. However, the mission successfully demonstrated the drag-free technology that would be required for LISA. So this was done by measuring the displacement between the two masses to within 0.01 nanometers. So that same precision will be achievable for LISA, since it does not depend on the separation between the masses. And so impressively, the performance of Pathfinder has exceeded its own target, and in fact, it's already met the mission requirements of LISA itself. So in this plot here, the red line is the full LISA noise requirement, and blue is actual Pathfinder noise. Okay, so there are several key issues in the LISA inverse problem that make it quite different from ground-based gravitational wave astronomy with the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra detectors. So the most fundamental one, in some sense, is the modeling of the instrument and the noise in the data. So the response of LISA to a passing gravitational wave is very complicated, because it depends on the dynamical orbits of not just the six inertial masses in the spacecraft, but also the spacecraft themselves. And the evolving arm lengths and the laser phase noise, they are accounted for by a technique called time delay interferometry, or TDI, which takes optical path combinations to form three noise orthogonal channels. However, the application of this TDI technique can be quite computationally costly. And we also have to deal with transient noise sources, such as scheduled gaps, which are typically 7 hours long every 2 weeks, unscheduled gaps, which can be even longer, and also glitches, which can occur at both high and low frequencies. And finally, even without these transient effects, the noise itself will still be non-stationary over the duration of most LISA signals, and that will call for a time-evolving noise power spectral density model. So in terms of the actual science analysis, the first major issue in the LISA inverse problem is signal confusion. So this is the fact that LISA data will contain a large number of signals that overlap in both time and frequency. So in particular, there will be anywhere from 10 to 1,000 massive black hole mergers in the data set, 1 to 10,000 EMRIs, and 10,000 to 100,000 resolvable galactic white dwarf binaries, among other things. So we can't just look for these signals once, find them, subtract them, and then move on. The reason is that doing so will strongly bias the significance of any detections and the accuracy of their estimated parameters. So a global solution to this is required, where all the signals are searched for and analyzed simultaneously. So it's not actually practical to do this fully simultaneously. So instead, one possible compromise could be to handle the different source types separately, since they are relatively orthogonal to one another. And this global fit algorithm will then involve separate pipelines that both update and look up the existing solution for the LISA catalog repeatedly. So this in turn makes the streamlining of the techniques and code that we use very important. That's so that the global solution is not held up too much by a single pipeline. So the second issue is searching for and also resolving all the overlapping sources in the data. So for certain types of source, the size of the parameter space can be very huge. So I don't just mean in terms of dimensionality, which is roughly the same as it is for the LIGO-Virgo sources, but also in terms of the information volume of the space. So as a result, credible regions for certain signals can be very localized in parameter space, and thus they can be very difficult to find. And the probability surface over the source parameter space can also be highly multimodal, especially for source types such as white dwarf binaries. You can see in this picture here, where there are multiple overlapping signals. And so self-confusion is an issue. For EMRIs, we will also run into the problem of degeneracies, where a single signal can cause multiple modes in the probability surface. So as I've hinted at in the talk outline and also in the abstract for this talk, I will come back to this point later. Okay, so if the parameter space is very large, then grid-based approaches like your standard template banks that you use in LIGO-Virgo searches, they quickly become very impractical. So stochastic algorithms will then have to be employed in the search stage, in addition to their traditional usage during inference. However, the focus for search will be on global exploration of the parameter space instead of local convergence as an inference. So these search methods will probably be hierarchical, you know, searching at different resolutions, and they may require multiple passes over the data as well due to their stochastic nature. But the real difficulty with these algorithms is that even though stochastic search is the most efficient way of covering parameter space, we will still require many, many waveform templates in such algorithms. And generating these templates and as well as performing operations on them can be very computationally expensive. So finally, the third issue is accuracy. So this is only really relevant for strong field sources with very high signal-to-noise ratios, or SNR. So the combination of complexity and strength leads to a very high degree of signal variability over parameter space. So there are only two types of such sources for LISA, namely massive black hole mergers and EMRIs. So they are naturally the most interesting types of sources to study, but unfortunately, they are also the most difficult to model. So for these sources, we will be in the regime where the theoretical error from imperfect modeling might actually exceed the statistical error due to noise. And that, of course, leads to systematic bias. So in terms of how these translates into waveform errors, generally, we will need waveform mismatches of at most 10 to the minus 4 or so to avoid this bias, and possibly much lower than that as well, depending on how high the SNR gets. So achieving this required accuracy in our best models is already difficult already, but it's only the first step because these models, these very accurate models, they are unlikely to be directly usable in data analysis. So we then have to use these accurate models as a base for informing and constructing more efficient ones. But we also have to ensure that these efficient models are still accurate enough for inference, because that's the whole point of the accuracy requirement in the first place. So this, for LISA, is generally not achievable yet. Because I said, remember, we require mismatches of 10 to the minus 4. But if we just use the standard existing techniques for ground-based detectors, you can see even NR waveforms themselves do not meet this requirement. Okay, so now on to extreme mass ratio in spirals. So these sources arise from the capture of stellar mass compact objects by massive black holes in galactic nuclei. So those that emit in the LISA band will have about 10,000 to 100,000 observable orbits deep in the strong field of the central black hole. And their gravitational wave signals will typically persist over the entire mission lifetime, or at least a significant fraction of it. At the same time, because of the strong field nature of these orbits, they can exhibit extreme versions of relativistic precession, and they can also retain significant eccentricity right up to the point where they plunge. So this gives the gravitational wave signals a lot of harmonic complexity as well. So numerical relativity provides the most accurate physical models that we have for comparable mass binaries. But it cannot be easily used to model EMRIs because of the greatly differing scales of length, mass, and time in the system. So the best approach here is black hole perturbation theory with the small mass ratio as a perturbation parameter. And that works well because the motion of the compact object is almost geodesic in the extreme mass ratio limit. And the gravitational field of the compact object causes a perturbation to the background black hole spacetime. And that can be expressed as an effective self-force, of course, on a time-like curve geodesic. So in order to meet the LISA science requirements, we will need EMRI waveforms that are phase accurate to within 1/SNR radians, roughly, where typical SNRs range from tens to hundreds. So this requirement actually needs us to compute the self-force terms up to the dissipative part of the second order term. So a practical scheme for second order self-force calculations has recently been implemented by Adam Palm and his collaborators. So this is only for quasi-circular orbits in Schwarzschild so far, but it represents a significant milestone after more than a decade of work by the community in this area. So unfortunately, in terms of EMRI astrophysics, many unknowns still remain. So some of these uncertainties are, for example, in the massive black hole mass function, in the fractions of massive black holes hosted in dense stellar cusps, as well as in the intrinsic emery rate per massive black hole. So as a result, the expected number of emeries that will be observed by LISA actually spans three orders of magnitudes, from possibly one, or maybe zero, if you're pessimistic, to tens of thousands. Another potentially important issue is the recently identified problem of brown dwarfs around massive black holes. So these small stars are abundant in galaxies, and they can orbit very close to the central black hole for millions of years without being tidally disrupted. And although I use the word problem here, in these papers cited here, they actually put a positive spin on brown dwarfs as a possible source for LISA, because there may be several in our galaxy that are close enough to Sagittarius A star to be observable. However, if brown dwarfs are generically present around other massive black holes, then they might perturb the orbits of regular emeries, or they may even reduce the likelihood of them forming in the first place due to scattering. So, okay, the presence of brown dwarfs might mess up modeling, analysis, and event rates, and there may also be other unforeseen environmental effects to complicate matters as well. Then you might ask the question, why are we bothering with emeries in the first place? So I think there are several good reasons. So the first and the most commonly cited one is that measurements with emery signals can be done to very high precision, and thus they have great potential for areas such as a massive black hole and galaxy astrophysics or tests of fundamental physics. So the second has to do with the global fit issue I mentioned earlier. So even if LISA data contains just a single emery signal, it will have to be accurately subtracted. And the final reason is, I guess, simply for the challenge. So pretty much everything about the emery inverse problem is very challenging. And now I'll explain why this is the case. So the short reason is that emeries are the only LISA sources that are both strong field and long lived. Hence, they epitomize all the key issues in the LISA inverse problem. So in other words, everything is hard for emeries, and that's not even taking into account the broader astrophysical environment, which I won't talk about here. So let's do a more detailed breakdown of the practical difficulties in the modeling and analysis of emeries. So the first, of course, is accuracy. So that's historically been the main focus of the waveform modeling community. So emeries are, of course, a strong field highest in our sources that require very accurate modeling to find and as well to characterize. So, waveform phasing that's accurate to post one adiabatic order, that is to say, you know, the phasing should contain effects up to one order in mass ratio beyond the leading adiabatic order. That should be enough for our purposes. However, as I said earlier, this will require second order self-force calculations, and we are not quite there yet. Okay, so the second difficulty is efficiency. So that's largely been more of a concern for the data analysis community instead. So emery signals are long-lived with very rich harmonic content that makes them very costly to both to model as well as to analyze. And this statement is already valid for just a single waveform, but stochastic algorithms in data analysis, they require the bulk generation of at least billions of waveforms. Now, the third difficulty has to do with extensiveness, or how thorough our models and analyses are relative to the full inverse problem. So waveform models can be built, of course, for special cases, such as quasi-circular orbits or Schwarzschild orbits, but the bare minimum for describing an astrophysically relevant emery is a model for generic orbits in Kerr spacetime. And this leading order space of orbits already has a massive information volume because the waveforms are highly sensitive to small changes in the parameters. And so our models and analyses must be able to cover the full parameter space. And also waveforms are only half the battle. That's because the detector response itself also encodes important extrinsic effects about the source. And in the case of LISA, the response is also highly non-trivial to model accurately and efficiently. Okay, so as LISA moves closer to becoming a reality, so I think all three difficulties that I've highlighted on the previous slide, they become more relevant to both the modeling and the analysis communities as a whole. So on the modeling side, there are still no waveform models that satisfy all the LISA requirements for accuracy, efficiency, and extensiveness. So this naturally restricts the analysis end. In particular, there has not been any sort of global analysis that's been performed on the space of possible signals from a given waveform model, not even a toy model. So in the second half of my talk, which I'll go on to now, I will discuss some recent and ongoing developments on these two fronts. So specifically, I will describe a framework for the next generation of Emory waveform models, and also two early models in this framework that already significantly improve on aspects of existing first generation models. And I'll also report briefly on the results of a heuristic study on the signal space of a first generation model. And I will present concrete evidence of global parameter degeneracies in the space, where the existence of these degeneracies has only been suspected so far from local analysis. Okay, let's start off with some simple definitions. I'll refer to an Emory waveform model as a model that is accurate in that it is at least fully relativistic, but it is not necessarily efficient, nor is it necessarily extensive. So all existing examples of these are only accurate up to adiabatic order, and they're produced by solving the Tikhonovsky equation for the vowel scalar psi 4 on Kerr space time. So such models have up to now been very slow to compute, and they're also quite limited in their extensiveness so far. Now, a template model, on the other hand, is not necessarily accurate, but it must be both efficient and extensive. So Emory data analysis studies so far, they have made use of template models known as kludges in order to build up our qualitative understanding of the inverse problem, as well as our strategies for tackling it. Unfortunately, such models all rely on some form of weak field approximation, and so they cannot really be made more accurate. Thus, we will consider any semi-relativistic model as being inaccurate for the purposes of LISA. So the aim is for the next generation of models to be accurate, efficient, and extensive. So I stress again that accuracy here is only in the sense that they are fully relativistic, not that they fulfill the full post-adiabatic accuracy requirements for inference. So the two new models that are present in this talk are accurate and efficient, but they have not been made extensive yet. Okay, so here I'll briefly sketch out the framework of a waveform model that can be used for LISA data analysis, but of course, after we've made it efficient and extensive. So that is to say, we will need runtimes for a single waveform to be under a second or so, and eventually we'll need to apply the detector response as well to the end of the waveform. So the description of the waveform here is the standard modular one for Emory's, where it is decomposed into amplitude, phase, and angular dependence, as in the comparable mass case, but also uniquely into the harmonics of the fundamental frequencies. So the underlying in-spiral orbit for this Emory is described here as a trajectory of oscillating geodesics. And as I said earlier, we'll need to model generic Kerr orbits and also to account for important post-adiabatic effects such as transient resonances and the spin of the secondary. We also need the phasing of the waveform up to post one adiabatic order and the mode amplitudes up to adiabatic order. So I'll touch more on this, the amplitude point shortly. Okay, so because of the modular nature of this waveform framework, it can be used to build a whole inventory of waveform models that prioritize either speed or accuracy for different data analysis applications. So there are several existing or eventual options that could be considered for the in-spiral trajectory piece. So when searching for sources, we could use less accurate but maybe marginally faster trajectories that are based on analytic post-Newtonian fluxes or numerical Tikhonovsky-based fluxes. Although the PN fluxes will only provide partial coverage of the full parameter space, of course. For inference purposes, we will want more accurate trajectories that are still very fast. So these are likely to come from the application of near identity averaging transforms to the evolution of a self-forced in-spiral trajectory. And such transforms are naturally included in the final two-timescale framework that will be used to generate post-adiabatic trajectories for the final model. So we also need to deal with transient resonances. So these are jumps in the in-spiral trajectory that occur when the harmonic frequencies coincide. So strong resonances will typically occur at least once for most sources, and they will be the dominant subleading effect on the waveform, because they changed the phasing at post half adiabatic. So we will need practical schemes for accurately and efficiently incorporating resonances into the waveform framework. And I suspect our final solution will probably involve pre-computing and fitting the resonance jump vectors across the various resonance surfaces in geodesic space. Although there is always the slower but more accurate option of switching to full self-force evolution whenever you get close to resonance. So that's not been worked out yet. Similarly, for the mode amplitudes, we also have different options that could be used in the waveform framework. So this is where PN calculations could actually be quite useful, I think, because they might be actually accurate enough at large separations and low eccentricities to be used directly in the analysis models. So this would then reduce the complexity of the interpolation or fitting problem for the numerical amplitudes over the rest of the space. And interpolation, so here interpolation would be a more accurate way of computing the amplitudes, of course, but because it's a local procedure that typically depends on a dense set of data during runtime, in general, it will be more expensive than if one were to pre-compute a less accurate global fit to the amplitudes. So these are the options. And all these amplitude models are only accurate up to adiabatic order. So is that accurate enough for Lisa inference? So I don't think this question has been answered formally in the literature, but we can look at it sort of heuristically. So say we have a sine wave, a sinusoidal waveform, call it waveform one, with frequency omega, and let's look at 1,000 cycles of it. So let's consider another waveform two, yeah, with a fractional difference of 10 to the minus 4 in the frequency, and that makes it actually less than 1 radian out of phase after the same duration. And then let's look at waveform three, which has a fractional difference of 10 to the minus 1 in the amplitude. And that's manifested as some higher frequency oscillations you can see here in the plot. So the question is which waveform two or three has a better match or overlap with waveform one. And as it turns out, maybe not surprisingly, the waveform with 10% amplitude error is still a better match than the one with 0.01% frequency error. So accurate phasing is therefore much more important for data analysis. And yes, adiabatic amplitudes will probably be okay for LISA. Okay, so that doesn't mean that amplitudes are not important. And that's because the relative amplitudes among the many harmonic modes, they do affect the phasing as well. However, the interpolation or fitting of amplitudes is very computationally challenging. So even if we restrict to the relevant modes that actually contribute significantly to a particular waveform, the number of modes that we consider can still range from thousands to hundreds of thousands. So that's a pretty big problem. But an even bigger one is actually that for a Kerr waveform, we would need the amplitudes over a 3 or 4-dimensional geodesic space. And as we know, interpolation rapidly becomes difficult whenever you are dealing with more than 2 dimensions. And finally, all of this is just for a single oscillating geodesic, and we will need many such evaluations of the interpolant or the fit along the in-spiral trajectory. Okay, so now let's move on to the first of the two new models in this talk. So this model, model one, is the combination of work that's been done over the past couple of years in collaboration with Michael Katz, Niels Warburton, and Scott Hughes. So this work is currently in review from the archive already. And the source code is already publicly available. I'll show the URL later. The model that we have so far is for eccentric Schwarzschild orbits without any subleading order effects. So the waveform here then loses all the K modes, the K index modes associated with the polar frequency. And the in-spiral trajectory itself, G, is now described only in terms of the separation P, semilattice rectum, P, and the eccentricity E. The waveform is also decomposed in terms of spherical rather than spheroidal harmonics. So that simplifies a small aspect of the computation. And finally, the trajectory that we use is accurate up to adiabatic order only. So that means there's no oscillatory piece in the phasing. But apart from all these differences, they are significant, but you can already see that many important elements of the overall framework, they are already in place in our Schwarzschild model. So, okay, the inspiral trajectory that we use in this model is based on fluxes computed from numerical solutions of the Tikhonovsky equation. So this is essentially a model here that takes as input the initial P and E, as well as the mass ratio, and then returns the oscillating trajectory and the phase trajectory after plunge. So the numerical data is computed at very high accuracy on a dense grid in P and E space, and then a standard interpolation scheme and ODE solver is used to construct the trajectory, also to high accuracy. Now for the mode amplitudes, we have taken a more unconventional approach of using a neural network to fit the numerical Tikhonovsky data. So we consider modes up to L equals 10 and N equals plus minus 30. So if all these modes are vectorized, they live in a 3,843 dimensional complex vector space. And that's of course isomorphic to R7686. So the reason we use a neural network is not just because it's recently become the trendy thing to do, but also because it provides a global fit that's not very precise, but it does scale well with dimensionality. So this means that neural networks are actually quite well suited to the job of fitting mode amplitudes, I think. So specifically, we are using a variant of a technique called Roman. So that's a combination of reduced order modeling and deep learning for gravitational wave data analysis. So Roman was originally proposed by Chad Galley, Michele Ballesteri, and myself as a method of fitting a given waveform model in the same way as a reduced order model surrogate waveform. Although the neural network fit is slightly more difficult in practice, it can actually provide a powerful alternative to this combined framework of surrogates and reduced order quadrature. So that has become quite widely used in Lego-Virgo modeling and analysis. But in this work, we use Roman to instead fit the set of mode amplitudes. So a reduced basis for the modes is constructed from the same data set that was used in the trajectory model. And then every amplitude in the span of that set can be represented by its basis coefficients alpha. And what that does is that reduces the effective dimensionality of the mode space, which was 7686, if you recall on the previous slide, by around a factor of 40 down to 198. So, okay, we then train the neural network on this reduced map alpha, and we test it on some domain here. It's described here in words. It roughly corresponds to the space of centric Schwarzschild emeries that may be observable by LISA. So the error of the network amplitudes with respect to the numerical amplitudes is quantified by what we're going to call the mode distribution error, which is just really 1 minus the cosine of the inner product angle between the two. And the distribution error best captures the error in the relative amplitudes. So that's really what we care about the most. So in this plot here, it's represented by a color bar. So you can see that the network here, it actually does less well close to the separatrix as expected, and also at high eccentricity. So these points are slightly lighter. But the maximal error, which is this point here, across this whole test domain is still very small at around 10 to the minus 4. Okay, so here, let me have a quick aside. If we are using reduced order modeling, why don't we apply it directly to the full waveform representation as done in ground-based modeling and analysis? So there's been an early investigation in this direction by Rifat and collaborators. So it's a nice bridge between numerical relativity and perturbation theory, although I would say it's actually more relevant to the IMRI regime, the intermediate mass ratio regime. And unfortunately, surrogates, in my opinion, are very unlikely to be useful for emeries because the number of cycles in an emery signal means you would need a huge reduced basis just to cover more than a tiny patch of parameter space. And in fact, even the NR surrogates themselves, they are barely viable for LISA massive black holes right now because they don't have enough cycles, but also because the accuracy that they do achieve falls short of what is required by LISA. So okay, back to the waveform framework. So in terms of implementation, we are continuing the trend of recent work by some of us, mainly Michael Katz and myself, on using GPUs in gravitational wave modeling for LISA. So in our initial code release, we provided three separate waveform models. So the first of which is what we're calling the slow waveform. So that actually is essentially the model I described earlier, but it interpolates the mode amplitudes in a different way, in a regular slow way, so not with a neural network. It also integrates the trajectory with dense steps, and then it also makes no other approximations for the sake of efficiency. Now, the second model is the CPU implementation of the model I just described with various approximations like sparse trajectory integration and also summing a reduced selection of modes. And our third and main implementation is nearly identical to that, but it's coded to run natively on a GPU. So the URL for our waveform framework is given here. So please take a look and try out the new model. Even if you don't have a GPU, you can run the CPU one. And right, so I should also mention that in the latest version, we have also added an improved augmented analytic clues model, or AAK, to the overall framework as well. So this is an inaccurate but extensive waveform. So, and it's the main one that's going to be used in ongoing data analysis studies while we work to extend the relativistic waveforms to Kerr. Okay, so our benchmarking results are very promising. So with our fast GPU implementation, we can achieve speeds of tens to hundreds of milliseconds. And this is for analysis length waveforms with a few million points, as well as full harmonic content. So that's shown by the blue bar here at the top of this plot for GPU. We've also provided a breakdown of the wall time taken by each individual module of the waveform. So the fast CPU waveform, the orange bar, typically takes minutes to generate, which is slightly slower than what the current, what the much simpler Kluge waveforms can currently do. However, this is only with a single CPU core. It would be straightforward to get up to a factor of five speed up through simple parallelization. And in some sense, the CPU waveform is right up against the limit of what can be achieved on a CPU because its computational cost, this orange bar here, is already dominated by the summation procedure that takes place at the full sampling resolution of the final waveform. And finally, the slow waveform takes hours to generate. So, right, in fact, the bottleneck for this slow waveform is not just the summation, but you can see it's also the interpolation of the mode amplitudes. So this shows the importance of using a fast fit for the amplitudes rather than standard interpolation. And importantly, we don't sacrifice much accuracy to gain this speed. And this is quantified by comparison to the slow waveform, which is taken as a fiducial waveform in our benchmarking for accuracy. So this plot shows the accumulated mismatch as an EMRI evolves from its initial orbit. So that's indicated by the gray points on the boundary. So since there's no defacing along these trajectories, we're using the same, essentially the same phase trajectories, then the accumulated mismatch is actually slightly worse at earlier times due to the reduced amplitude accuracy at high eccentricity. And then it eventually gets better as the EMRI circularizes. So for the worst case EMRI in our domain of validity, so that's indicated by this top trajectory in the plot, we find a full waveform mismatch of less than 4 × 10⁻⁴. So as mentioned earlier, this level of mismatch might be good enough for inference because it allows us to measure the parameters of high SNR EMRI without incurring significant bias from model error. Oh, and finally, if you want an idea of what a mismatch of 4 × 10⁻⁴ looks like in terms of the waveform itself, so here are the snapshots for the initial and the final segments of the worst case waveform over a year. So this essentially corresponds to the points in geodesic space with the least accurate amplitudes. And so this sort of level of visual disagreement, if you can see any disagreement, is the worst you'll ever get with our model. Okay, so now I'll talk a bit more briefly about a second model. I'm also involved with this, but to a lesser extent. So this work is led by Soichiro Isoyama at University of Southampton. And we're aiming to put out both the code and the paper within a month or two. So this model essentially uses the latest PN calculations for generic Kerr orbits, and it combines them into a full waveform model that is accurate up to adiabatic order, or at least a PN approximation to adiabatic order. And as far as I'm aware, this has not been done before because all the EMRI PN results so far have either not been for generic Kerr or they have only come in the form of specific waveform pieces, such as the fluxes. Okay, so the trajectory model in this waveform has been implemented already. It's based on flux expansions up to 5pn order and the 10th power of eccentricity. So interestingly, even though these are pn fluxes, they are actually reasonably accurate up to a separation of as small as 10m. Or at least they are accurate as far as adiabatic fluxes go. So in particular, they generally appear to match numerical data better than the Tikhonsky-fitted fluxes that were derived by Guerra and Glapatakis in 2006. So we illustrate this here in several plots of flux error against separation, flux error on the vertical axis against separation, for a representative set of geodesics, where the PN errors in green, they are consistently lower at separations that are greater than 10m. So that's the dashed line. So this means that the 5PN model might now actually be the most accurate adiabatic trajectory model for generic curl orbits, because nobody has really built one from numerical Tikhonsky fluxes yet. Okay, so the amplitude model in this model also consists of 5PN OE10 expansions. It's been recently implemented as well. However, we're currently assessing the domain of validity for these PN amplitudes. And I'll just say that the hope is for them to be accurate enough up to around 10m as well. But the full waveform implementation is done on CPU. And from our early investigations, we find that it's less than 10 times slower than the CPU implementation of model one. So that's actually somewhat expected, because in a generic curl waveform, there are roughly 30 times more modes to be summed than in an eccentric Schwarzschild waveform. But at the same time, the PN amplitudes themselves are faster to evaluate than the neural network amplitudes. And so you can claw back some speed from there. And finally, a potential feature of this waveform is the inclusion of approximate resonance jumps in the trajectory model. So that could help with studying data analysis approaches for resonances. And that's possible because we can calculate resonantly enhanced fluxes from the generic curl mode amplitudes, including the horizon amplitudes that are not used in the rest of the waveform. So these resonant fluxes then allow us to directly compute the leading order jumps during waveform generation, whenever the in-spiral trajectory crosses any resonance surface. Okay, I want to leave some time for the next section, so I won't go into details about future work on these next generation models, except to say that there are some obvious next steps to improve the efficiency and extensiveness of both models. So that's not just on the source end, where we'll need to add more physics to the model, but also to the detector end, where the aim is to integrate the waveform with a response model that is also efficient or more efficient. Okay, so now let's take a trip into the uncharted space of EMRI signals, as promised earlier. So to start off, I would like you to consider a more geometric picture of the usual setup in gravitational wave data analysis. So, okay, so first let's consider a LISA data channel of 2 years sampled at 0.1 Hertz. So the data space D is then a 6 million dimensional Hilbert space, where the inner product on this space is the usual noise weighted inner product, weighted by the PSD of LISA noise. So that's shown here. Okay, now consider an EMRI waveform model with N parameters. So this model actually defines an embedding of the parameter space P into the data space. And the image of the embedding, that's what we're going to call the signal space S, is an n-dimensional submanifold of D. So one can then interpret the usual analysis quantities in the setting of classical differential geometry. And in particular, I'll point out that the Fisher information metric on P is really just the pullback of the Euclidean metric on D. And finally, consider the standard gravitational wave likelihood, which I've written out here, rather the negative log likelihood times two. So here, a single EMRI signal is injected with a zero noise realization. So let's call this injection H star. So the likelihood, as written here, can be thought of as a function on the signal space S. And for any point H, or any template point H in S, it essentially returns the distance in D from H star. Note that that's not the same as the geodesic distance in S. And because the embedding that's defined by the waveform model is highly nonlinear, in general, you can run into a scenario where points have a very large separation in the parameter space P, but also a very small separation in the data space D, as in they resemble each other. So this is what I will refer to, of course, as degeneracy. So what do we know about the signal space S for EMRIs? So for one, we do know it's very big. So this is quantified by the integral of the Fisher volume form over parameter space. So that was estimated by John Gehr and collaborators back in 2004. We also understand the local likelihood correlations pretty well at any given point in parameter space, since these are precisely the Fisher correlations at that point. They can be computed easily. We also know from the previous round of mock Lisa data challenges that the EMRI likelihood surface over parameter space has some secondary peaks that are clearly separated from the primary peak that corresponds to the injection point. So these secondaries are a result of signal space degeneracy. And unfortunately, that's all we know. Nothing is known about the prevalence, distribution, and properties of the secondaries in the likelihood. So to try and address this, Kurt Cutler and I have performed a heuristic study of the EMRI signal space. We should be writing up our findings over the next month or so. So our strategy is this. So we pick a relatively central point in the parameter space as the injection. We then map out the likelihood or some related surface at very high resolution. And the target is to cover this, the target coverage for this map is the full parameter space, or at least as close as we can get to it. So all of this sounds very straightforward, but it's actually a surprisingly non-trivial task that we've been working on for the last 3 years. And the reason is that all the standard tools that we might employ for this task, ranging from the waveform model itself to the sampling and the clustering algorithms, they're actually quite ill-suited to the job. So in order to make any sort of progress, we've had to develop new tools and techniques as we went along. So the first of this is the waveform itself, as well as the standard inner product operation on the waveform. So the waveform we study is the AAK model with an approximate response. But even though this Kluge waveform is designed for efficiency, it's still not fast enough for the job. So we've stripped it down significantly by just considering the four strongest harmonic modes. So that's a reasonable approximation at low eccentricity. We also return only the noise-weighted amplitude and phase trajectories. So these are smooth and they can be highly downsampled. So the trajectories for these four harmonics are shown here in red, overlaid on a spectrogram for a typical signal. So we also define an approximate inner product to act on those smooth trajectories. So for two waveforms, that's just H1 and H2, that's just the dot product of the amplitudes, A1 and A2, but only considering the times T, where the difference between the phase trajectories, phi1 and phi2, is less than 1 radian. So I won't explain that too much, but that roughly corresponds to the envelope of the standard inner product acting on the full waveforms. Okay, so I'll point out here that this project actually began before the recent GPU work. So we're not using the new GPU version of the AAK. But with both of these approximations, we can actually do things about 10 times faster than with the GPU implementation anyway. Okay, so the traditional likelihood surface actually turns out to have large scale SNR gradients in it. So that sort of hinders the study of secondary peaks. So we quickly realized that we really want to look at the overlap surface instead. So that's just the normalized inner product. So that's closely related to the likelihood surface for waveforms with unit SNR, SNR1. So what we did is we defined an exploratory likelihood here. It's a bit arbitrary, but it's designed to suppress the volume in the probability tails, and that's to better locate and explore secondaries with sampling. Importantly, however, the secondaries can't be resolved through direct visualization of the posterior samples. And the main reason for this is that we are looking at a moderately high dimensional parameter space, and actually there are quite a lot of secondaries. So the standard sampling is only used to obtain a large set of points that have very high overlap with the injection point. And then we use a follow-up clustering analysis on this data set. So that's actually the hardest part of the problem, because we have to come up with our own algorithm for the task. So there are two main types of clustering algorithm, centroid-based and density-based, for those who know something about it. Well, I won't go into details, but basically they are not suitable for this task. So I won't go into the details of our algorithm as well, because that would take a whole other talk. But I think the takeaway is that we examine overlaps along connecting lines between points in parameter space. And we use this to define notions of connectedness for clustering purposes. Okay, so now on to the results, finally. Okay, I think these results are rather eye-opening, I think. So what we've done is we've considered an injected signal at the approximate threshold SNR of 20, and we look only at the six intrinsic parameters of the AAK model. So these are the two masses of the EMRI, the spin of the massive black hole, and the three orbital elements describing the initial geodesic. So we compute the full posterior with no approximations for this injection. It's near Gaussian, as expected. So for the projection onto the mass-mass plane here, you can see the contour of this posterior covariance ellipse for SNR20 in this plot here. So we then multiply these posterior bounds by a factor of 10 in each parameter dimension. And then we apply our procedure for finding secondaries to this enlarged region. And what we found is 30 secondary peaks in this region with quite significant overlaps from 0.45 all the way up to 0.7. So to assure you that our clustering algorithm is actually working, I'm not just showing you a bunch of points in parameter space. So let's look at the 5 points in this plot with the highest overlaps. So these include the primary peak as well here in the center. So there are 10 connecting lines between these points. And the plot on the right here shows the overlap surface if you drew lines between those points along all 10 of these connections. So you can clearly see that these points represent peaks that are distinct. And I also think this plot here on the right actually gives a nice flavor of how complex the signal space structure actually is. So we've also gone as far as extending the bounds by a factor of 100. That takes us to quite a significant fraction of the full parameter space. We repeat this analysis. We find a whole bunch more secondaries, 600, nearly 700. And they're shown in the plot on the right here. And somewhat surprisingly, the overlap values for these more distant points, they're not actually reduced by a great degree. So they still can go all the way up to 0.7. So I think we have convincing evidence now, as well as a pretty good understanding of the degree of degeneracy in EMRI signal space. So because I'm almost out of time, I will just conclude by saying that we're still considering the implications of these degeneracies for the EMRI inverse problem. However, we foresee that the main implications are mainly going to be just practical in nature. So in the sense that they will primarily affect the difficulty of stochastic sampling for EMRI search and inference. Okay, well, I'll just leave my summary slide up here. And that's it. That's my talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Alvin, for a great talk. Do we have questions for Alvin? So I was actually wondering, Alvin, in your waveform models, is it sort of how straightforward is it to include sort of these future effects that you were talking about, like resonances, spin evolution, or also do you wonder about like environmental effects, like drag forces from gas and things like that?
Yeah, so
that's something that can be easily included.
Right. So great question. So in terms of extending to the full generic Kerr orbits that we will need, right, that's the sort of the basic requirement for LISA analysis. We have a plan. I think it's doable basically because it's a very modular framework. So in some sense, what we do doesn't really depend on. So basically, the second order self-force people, they can work on the trajectory, and then eventually they will give us the two time scale framework, which we can just slot in here. So resonances we'll have to deal with separately, but I think we can do that. And also when we go to Kerr, the amplitude space becomes very much more high dimensional, but also I think the neural network approach should be able to cope with that. So in terms of the pure GR solution for Kerr, I think we have a plan. Again, no promises that it's gonna work, but we are aware of this, of the way forward. In terms of your question about environmental effects, I don't think that is on the cards, because partly because, you know, the parameter space is just too big, right? There's just so many effects you can consider. So I think that these, so firstly, this will be made easier with our framework. So if people actually want to develop their own models that incorporate these effects, maybe they will be able to do so themselves. And secondly, I think it will probably be done on an ad hoc basis. So I suspect, you know, in the same way that, you know, modified GR waveforms are not really developed. I mean, right now we're still putting effort into building up an inventory of modified GR waveforms, but that's not the first priority, right? We want to get the GR solution correct first.
Right.
So I think in the same way, environmental effects will be handled like that as well. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah. So I was just notified that apparently people are muted, and so people can actually ask questions because Zoom doesn't let them to unmute themselves. We're working on this. I'm not entirely sure how to do this. I'm not host, so I believe I don't have the rights to do that. But maybe if Josh is around from IT, maybe he can jump in and help us unmute people.
Are you? I'm surprised you're not the host, actually. Let me try it.
Mute participants. Okay, maybe now it should work. I actually found.
I think I did it. Yeah.
Oh, you did it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So maybe Juan, can you try and see if you can unmute yourself? Okay, still doesn't work. It seems. Can you try again, Juan? Or someone else? Anna?
Oh, yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, now it's working. People. There we
go. Okay, perfect. Okay, there we go. Finally found it. Good. Okay, do we have more questions for Alvin at this point?
Well, maybe I can ask a question. So you mentioned about this brown dwarf problem. Can you? So I was wondering how close are these brown dwarfs, and like how much time these brown dwarfs will spend near these supermassive black holes?
I'm not an expert on this area. I'm just going by what the astrophysicists tell me. But I think if you can work it out that they can actually spend millions of years very close to the black hole without being disrupted.
Okay.
So basically, if there are any brown dwarfs very close to, say, Sagittarius A star, when we turn on LISA, then they might be in the data as well. That's what they think. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be interesting, because if there is such brown dwarfs near the supermassive black hole, then if you have Emery, then you could have these tidal resonances generated by the brown dwarfs, and possibly you can see that in the waveform as well. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm also looking at tidal resonances, following your paper with Beatrice, and yeah, because I think one of the main motivation to look at that is because of the possibility that brown dwarfs may come into play, in which case your tidal resonances may actually be very a generic feature of Emery waveforms. But at the same time, if that really is true, then it's going to be, well, very hard to do any sort of modeling, I would say. And then the second order self-force work may be in vain.
Right. In some sense, it's a little bit similar to those transient resonances, right? You also, it has more generic resonance condition, but I think if you are able to compute the transient resonances, maybe you can also do that for the tidal resonances.
Yeah, I agree. But I think the main problem actually is more on the analysis side. So the parameter space of whenever you have a tidal resonance, you then have to add the parameters of the
perturber. Right,
yeah, and then that could, you know, that makes the problem very big. So.
So just a naive question, do we actually expect lots of brown dwarfs around these supermassive black holes? I mean, astrophysically speaking?
I don't know. So I mean, if you read those two papers where that's the claim that's being made, they say that, you know, in the LISA band, so for an emery in the LISA band, it actually starts quite close in the strong field. But I think the prediction is that you may actually get around order 10 brown dwarfs that are closer.
Okay.
So okay, interesting. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's something that we should keep in mind and maybe prepare for.
So I have another question. So, I mean, in the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that your models would satisfy this accuracy and efficiency requirement, but not mm-hmm. necessarily the extensiveness requirement. In what sense it does not satisfy the third requirement?
You mean our current models, right?
Yeah.
Right. So our current models, so the first model, model one, is not extensive in the sense that it's still only in Schwarzschild. So that's what I meant, yeah. So we want to extend that to generic curve. And then the second model, well, actually the PN model is, I would say it's extensive, but also in terms of extensiveness, I would consider, you know, you also have to include the detector response as well. You want to make the model as complete as you can make it.
Right, but that's something you can just, I mean, you know how to deal with detector response, right? It's something.
Yes, but again, the devil is in the details, I think. So if you want to integrate models and make the whole thing efficient, I mean, it has to be done. I'm not saying that, yeah, it can't be done. It's just that right now, I don't consider them as fully extensive. Yeah. But okay. But yeah, the PN model is more extensive.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Juan. Do we have more questions?
Yeah, I was wondering if Alvin, you could speak to sort of the current accuracy of the detector response, how people model that.
That's a good question. So, I think so. Relative to what, though? Right now the most accurate things we have are from the LISA simulation group, right? And those. So I guess that would be the benchmark. And then if you consider those LISA simulators that are available, you know, like Synthetic LISA by Michele, and also LISA Code, LISA Node, stuff like that. I think those are also pretty accurate because they can be updated to include more accurate orbits, for example, for the LISA satellites. So those would be fine as well. But then the problem is that those are still really slow. So in analysis, what is typically used is some fast approximation, usually in the frequency domain. And for that, I do know the answer. I think it's about 1% error for those waveforms. For those sort of approximate responses. And as I argued earlier, I think a 1% error or 1% mismatch is not good enough if you want to do parameter estimation. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess the follow-up question is that something that's being actively pursued in the community?
Yes. So let me go to that slide. Right. So, okay. Again, I'm not too aware of really what everyone else is doing, but I can say that the JPL group, along with Michael Katz, we are actually looking at having a full LISA response model, but placing it on GPU so that you can then use it directly with your fast waveforms.
Yeah. That sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Reed. Any final questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank Alvin again for a great talk.
Thank you.
And yeah, thank you.